Except for I can't see out of these glasses. Okay. So the topic title tonight is Understanding the Four Noble Truths. You've probably heard this teaching before. It's maybe the most famous Buddhist teaching, and hopefully I can say
Hopefully I can
something
say something
new about it, but
new
just always good to
about it. Good
revisit
to
this
revisit this
teaching.
teaching.
I'm hearing an
I'm hearing an
echo
echo
of my own voice. Just for the Okay, there we go. And I also wanted to just start the talk by saying that my heart goes out to everyone affected by the Air India flight, the crash today in India, and just a very sad event to hear about. 242 passengers and 12 crew perished. Maybe one person might have survived, apparently. And I'm also aware that the world is kind of on fire these days, it feels like. If you turn on the news anyway, that's what we would be told. And so that many of us may be out exercising our right to protest peacefully this Saturday, which Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of the Buddhist monks I really look up to, has said that sometimes a sense of moral outrage is appropriate. And kind of use that as a guiding principle. If moral, if there's reason for moral outrage, then we don't do it out of a sense of anger, but we do it out of a sense of compassion to ease suffering. And that's one thing that the Four Noble Truths is really all about, is suffering and the end of suffering, and ultimately about compassion for ourselves, because we don't want to suffer, and compassion for others, because we don't want them to suffer and they don't want to suffer, right? So the Buddha, it said that one of the main purposes of a Buddha arising in the world is to kind of offer the insights of the Four Noble Truths. And I find that kind of interesting. So, what are the Four Noble Truths? I just have to. And what's interesting is there's a little bit of a task with each of the four truths. So, quoting one of the suttas, the first noble truth, the truth of is the truth of suffering. The Pali word is dukkha. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But this truth of suffering is to be fully understood. So we need to understand suffering, pain, unreliability, things like that. And then the second truth, the truth of suffering's origin, which is defined as craving, that this craving, the origin of suffering, is to be abandoned. So we want to understand suffering and abandon craving that is the cause of the suffering. And then the third truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. The Pali word we use for this is nibbana. And this is to be realized. So it's to be realized. And then the fourth truth is the truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is to be developed, which makes sense. So we develop the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, and ultimately this is what leads us out of suffering. And this really is a big, the one of the Buddhist chief disciples, Sariputta, it said he underscored the importance of this formula of the Four Noble Truths by saying that, quote, just as the footprints of all other animals of the jungle fit into the footprint of an elephant's footprint, which is declared chief with respect to size, so that's the biggest footprint, so whatever wholesome teachings there are can all fit into the Four Noble Truths. So it's kind of the idea is that all the other teachings from the Buddha can fit into this formula somewhere of the Four Noble Truths. And so this is obviously a very important teaching. And then it's often said that the Four Noble Truths have been compared to a medical diagnosis model, which I think is interesting. So, and then the Buddha is sort of like a physician in this, case. And the truth of dukkha is like a disease that we're suffering from. And the truth of the origin of dukkha is like the cause of the disease. The truth of the cessation of dukkha is like the disease is being cured. So it's how we feel when the disease is gone. And then the truth of the path leading to the cessation of dukkha is like the medicine that brings about the disease's cure, or I like to think of it as the course of treatment, right? And it was interesting, one time I went to the doctor, I just hadn't seen my doctor in what felt like a long time, and I'm not getting any younger here, so I thought I should just have a regular checkup, make sure I'm not missing anything health-wise. So I get to the doctor's office, and he seemed surprised that I would want a regular checkup for some reason. And he said, well, you know, your heart rate sounds fine. And he kept saying, like, are there anything bothering you? And he just sort of looked disappointed until I remembered, oh yeah, my shoulder was bothering me. I just kind of forgot about it. And then he got interested. And then my knee was sort of hurting recently. And as soon as I had specific things, then he sort of seemed excited, like, okay, now we can talk about what might have caused these, and then we can look at what, how, you know, a treatment, some way we could treat these, and maybe eventually you won't have a sore shoulder anymore, kind of thing. And but it was just interesting how that worked. So it does help to get a little bit specific with our suffering too, right? It's helpful to name it sometimes, and I do try to, I have in the past, use this as a formula when I noticed, oh, wow, I'm really suffering over, you know, this particular thing. Then I try to take a moment and say, well, okay, what is it that I'm wishing were different? Where's the craving in this that's causing the suffering in some way? And often it starts to be pretty obvious what it might be. And then, you know, it's said that just if we can let go of the craving. So once we see that the craving has arisen and that it's not really serving us, then hopefully we can kind of, it loses some of its grip on us and we can hopefully let it go. And I don't want to pretend that that's always easy, but, and then, you know, also there might be things we need to do to help us let go of the craving. Which would be more like the Fourth Noble Truth, looking for, you know, ways, wholesome things we can do to help us let go of the craving. So we'll get into more details about this in a minute. But it's interesting. I once asked a well-known Buddhist monk named Ajahn Amaro. I was interviewing him for a Buddhist newsletter, and I asked if he thought that a lot of people still come to Buddhism due to their suffering. And he smiled and said, oh, I think they all do, and started laughing. They all come because of their suffering. And then, but then he went on and he said, but it's also important that the Buddha didn't just teach the truth of suffering, dukkha. It's a two-part piece. If you only get part one, it's pretty grim, he said. The whole point is the end of suffering. Kind of it, right? And it's just important, kind of like the elephant footprint, that whenever we're suffering, maybe, probably we can stick our problem into this formula, this footprint of the Four Noble Truths. That's kind of what I'm hoping to point to tonight. And let's see, so maybe we'll say a little more about dukkha. And dukkha is a Pali word that means both mental and physical pain or suffering. It's often said that there's no one word in English that perfectly encapsulates the term dukkha. And one definition I heard from Joseph Goldstein recently, he's one of my teachers, that he got it from somewhere, I don't know where, but it was, quote, the inevitability of unwanted experiences. The inevitability of unwanted experiences. That's one definition of dukkha. And this scholar, Buddhist scholar named Rupert Gethin, has a book, The Foundations of Buddhism, and he says, rich in meaning and nuance, the word dukkha is one of the basic terms of Buddhist and other Indian religious discourse. Literally pain or anguish, in its religious and philosophical contexts, dukkha is, however, suggestive of an underlying sense of unsatisfactoriness or unease that must ultimately mar even our experience of happiness. Since any pleasant experience, this is the key too, that any pleasant experience too, whatever its basis, is ultimately unreliable and subject to loss. If we rest our hopes of final happiness in it, we are bound to be disappointed. Thus, dukkha can be analyzed in Buddhist thought, he says, by way of three kinds of dukkha, which are suffering as pain. So this could be mental or physical pain. This is one kind. Suffering as, or it says change. Everything we experience is changing moment to moment. And sometimes it's very rapidly changing. Sometimes it's very, very slowly changing. But everything is changing. And then lastly, as conditions. We're part of a world compounded of unstable and unreliable conditions. So the conditions might be perfect for whatever we're attached to right now, but, you know, 2 weeks from now, things may change. It's all unstable, unreliable, and we can't count on it. And so, but I think it's important to remember that, you know, I guess this is sort of like the bad news, that even pleasant experience is ultimately also can be dukkha because it will change. So that's, but it's not all bad news. It just means we can't be attached to it. Somehow all this reminded me of something that happened recently where, well, I guess it was just last weekend, but my daughter and my wife and my daughter went to a farm out in Sonoma County somewhere and picked fresh raspberries for, you know, and they came back and my daughter can really get into it. So they had a lot of raspberries and they're so fresh that they're about to go bad already. You know, like by the time you get them home, they're practically, so we froze some, but then we just had so many and the idea arose for us to bake a pie from scratch. This is not something that we do had ever done before, basically. So as a little family. So anyway, we proceeded to spend many hours, it seemed like, putting, and then also even days, because we thought we could all make it all at one go. And we found out you have to sort of create the dough, and then we couldn't do it, finish it till the next day. But anyway, so we put a lot of time and effort into creating this very beautiful raspberry pie with a few blackberries thrown in. And it was, you know, took it out of the oven. It actually turned out really well. And then we I just noticed that, you know, I think there was a lot of anticipation about this pie. And then we got really excited. And then we ate the pie, right? And then it was gone. And so even though it was completely pleasurable from beginning to end, and doing it with my wife and daughter was really fun, and, you know, it all went well. It went as well as baking a pie could have gone, especially for people who don't bake a lot of pies. And yet where is it now? You know, it's just completely gone. I took a photo of it, you know, but that's about it. And so this is kind of what we're talking about, even though that was totally pleasant. Where is the pie now? And so there's just nothing to be, if I thought I was going to somehow get lasting happiness from the Raspberry Pi, which of course I didn't, but you get the idea that everything is like that, though, is what the Buddha was trying to point to. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has a book called Noble Truths, Noble Path that came out just a couple of years ago, and it's all about the Four Noble Truths, but then it kind of expands on that theme, goes into a lot of teachings, but it's a beautiful book, and it's kind of what inspired the talk. And he says in the book, he says, in the first discourse, so the Buddha, it is said that the Buddha offered the teaching on the Four Noble Truths in the first discourse that he gave. So in the first discourse, the Buddha enumerates eight kinds of dukkha, eight kinds of suffering. The first four are birth, old age, sickness, and death, right? They're all unavoidable. And they can be grouped under the heading of physiological suffering. And the next three are union with the unpleasant, separation from the pleasant, like the pie, and not getting what one wants, which can be comprised under the heading of psychological suffering. So we got physiological suffering, psychological suffering, and then he says the last is the five clinging aggregates, which might be described as ontological or existential suffering. And the five clinging aggregates are kind of name and form, this body, this material form that we're in. Let's see, feeling, tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Just this ability to be aware at the sense doors. And it's said that we kind of, so the clinging aggregates are, that's kind of more ontological, existential type of suffering, is that we cling to these as I, me, and mine, even though they're these, they can be broken down, and we can't really say that I am my perception, and yet we feel that way. Okay, so the Pali word dukkha, can, you know, it's usually translated as suffering, and just an important word to know. But a lot of translators, a lot of modern Buddhist scholars are starting to just like to use the word dukkha, because it's more than just suffering, as we've been saying. And it has to do with the fact that all experience within the conditioned world is inherently, quote, defective, because it's subject to change, it's unstable. And every factor of being, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, every facet of experience, when looked at closely, turns out to be impermanent and therefore unreliable, unable to provide complete satisfaction. It is this sense of deficiency or lack that the word dukkha is intended to suggest. Ultimate release from dukkha can only be found in that which lies beyond the sphere of transience and mortality, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, that is nibbana, the unconditioned state, free from birth, decay, and death. So we'll talk more about that later, but that's, so I found that Bhikkhu Bodhi's description of this to be a useful pointer. And it sort of reminds me when my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, died. He was 87, and he'd been married to my grandmother for, I don't really know how long, many decades, right? And they were so closely associated. I remember we all sort of held our breath, you know, how is grandma going to do without grandpa in the picture anymore? Because it seemed like we imagined that she thought all of her happiness was tied to that relationship. And I think definitely she grieved his loss, but we were very pleasantly surprised when she sort of seemed to be doing pretty well even after he was gone. But I just remember, you know, that, so I think that often we can think that having some long-term relationship is going to give us lasting happiness, but even a relationship that goes well over many decades is still unreliable, unable to provide this complete satisfaction. And so then the second noble truth, that's a bit about the, you know, dukkha, and we have to really understand dukkha, as Joseph said, the inevitability of unwanted experiences, because even when it's pleasant, it's not going to last forever. It's like I took my daughter recently to the Santa Cruz Boardwalk. She'd been there once before. She gets to have cotton candy like once a year at the boardwalk. She, you know, loves the rides and everything. And we were there for, you know, hours until the point where I was about to drop. And she was having a great time. And then at some point, I had to say, all right, it's time to go. We're not going to, like, move in at the boardwalk. And of course, there was the inevitable, no, one more ride, you know. So there was that attachment, like, we can't leave. Of course, for me, there felt like the opposite. Anyway, because it's a lot on your sense doors going on at the boardwalk, and it was a crowded day. But anyway, so even something as exciting as the Santa Cruz Boardwalk inevitably comes to an end. All right, so the second noble truth, the Bhikkhu Bodhi says the origin of dukkha is the analysis of the four truths, is said to be tanha. That's the Pali word that's usually translated as craving, but literally means thirst. And he says it's a blind thirst for pleasure, for existence, and even annihilation that operates in the minds of all unenlightened beings. So this is interesting. There's different types of craving that are described. It's this thirst for sense pleasure of some kind, like the boardwalk at Santa Cruz or whatever, or for existence that we crave, you know, to be here, to be acknowledged, to be known, to be in the world. And then sometimes we crave to be out of the world. It's too hard. It's too difficult. I can't handle it. I want out. I call that the beam me up, Scotty type of craving, which just seemed like a great thing if you could be part of Star Trek and they could just have them beam you up. Because, you know, then in the old original Star Trek, anyway, that I watched when I was a kid, Captain Kirk and crew would be about to be, you know, killed by a terrible monster, and they would just say, beam me up, Scotty, and then they would dissolve and disappear and then reappear on the spaceship. So that's the fantasy version of the, you know, get me out of here type of craving. So, but in life, this is a very important type of craving to be able to identify, right? Because people do terrible things to themselves when caught in this craving, when they don't see a way out. And if we can practice and keep these teachings in mind and bring wisdom to the situation, we realize, oh, I'm just really caught by, you know, this craving for non-becoming is how it's often called. He called it craving for annihilation. But it's this sense of, this is too much, get me out of here. If we can just identify it as craving, and we know that craving won't last, right? Even if it seems like it will, craving, like everything else, is impermanent. It won't last. We don't have to act from that place. We can just be with the painful craving. So, let's see, supported the overcoming of dukkha, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, requires that craving be uprooted in its entirety, an attainment that the third noble truth declares a real possibility. Dukkha comes to an end with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving. the craving that maintains the round of rebirths, for example, it's craving that keeps us being reborn again and again in the cycle of samsara, is the Buddhist teaching on that. So the I'm just looking for my place here. But in terms of the craving, Joseph Goldstein gave a talk, I think is where I got this. He says, when I'm on retreat and I find myself desiring a cup of tea, if I shift my focus from the object, the tea, to the anticipated feeling of satisfaction, I can be aware that it is the pleasant feelings associated with the tea that are really what I'm after. It's then much easier to remember that these feelings are fleeting. Remembering this impermanence, I am less hooked by the object of desire. And then he says, if we focus on the object, which appears to be more real, it's harder to resist the desire. We are more fooled by the apparent substantiality of the object and less able to see its impermanence. And then when we focus on the feelings, we have a greater chance of remembering the impermanent nature of feeling, thus breaking the wanting. Still, he says, the habit pattern of wanting is very strong. Thoughts are tremendously seductive. When they go unnoticed, they have compelling power. They become the dictators of the mind. And so I think that is really, for me, that's a really helpful teaching to keep in mind. And it's interesting because at this point in my life, I'm trying to eat less sugar because my body, it's not really good for me at all. And, but we do get ice cream. Our daughter really loves ice cream, and it's hard. It would feel kind of mean to not give her some ice cream every now and then. So we buy ice cream, and then I'm a little bit of an addict. I'm an addictive type. And I know, so the ice cream's in the freezer. I don't really want to eat it, but I know it's there. And there is this little craving, that moment that will arise. And it's like Joseph says, I know the ice cream's there. It feels very real. If I'm focusing on the ice cream, it's hard to resist. But if I focus on, oh, I just want the little pleasant feeling of having some ice cream, if I can just remember, oh, but you know, I'll live if I don't get that pleasant feeling for a few moments, right? So it's like Joseph is saying, and then I'm able to just not open the freezer and touch the ice, you know, have any ice cream. I mean, sometimes I have a little bit of ice cream, whatever, but you get the idea. I just think this is an important thing, that if we focus on the object, we get more fooled. But if we can remember that what we're really going for is just this very fleeting, pleasant feeling, then we don't have to let that win us over. Okay, so let's see. Rupert Gethin, scholar, I think he lives in England, he also writes about this. He says, at first, desires may be like the trickle of a stream, but they grow into a river of craving, which carries us away like the current of a swiftly flowing river. And he says, craving is understood to crystallize as grasping or attachment. And the various things we like evoke desires in us. These turn to cravings, and as a result of our craving, we grasp at things and try to take possession of them. In short, we try to call them our own. And he says, Buddhist texts provide a stock list of found kinds of attachment. Attachment to the objects of sense desire, attachment to views or views and opinions, attachment to precepts and vows, an attachment to the doctrine of the self. The ultimately significant thing in all this is craving and attachment rather than whatever is the object of that attachment and craving. And he says, thus, it's not the objects of sense desire that cause us suffering, but our attachment to those. So I know it's a lot to throw at you, but that's just another description of this. And, you know, for me, these are just always good reminders, these kind of teachings, to hear them. And so that when I am out in my life and these different streams of desire, trickles of desire start to come in, if I can meet them with mindfulness, then I have a lot more choice in that moment. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, once we see that the objects of our attachment are flawed, beset with hidden dangers, we then realize that the way of escape lies in dropping our attachment to them. And that kind of brings us to the third noble truth, which is about, you know, letting go, really. Rupert Gethin again says, the Buddhist solution to tanha and dukkha, or dukkha and tanha, is as radical as it is simple. Let go. Let go of everything. If craving is the cause of suffering, then the cessation of suffering will surely follow from the complete fading away and ceasing of that very craving. It's abandoning, relinquishing, releasing, letting go. The cessation of craving is then the goal of the Buddhist path, and equivalent to the cessation of suffering, the highest happiness, nibbana. Literally, nibbana means blowing out or extinguishing, although Buddhist commentarial writings explain it as the absence of craving. So one of the definitions of nibbana, or the descriptions of nibbana, is the absence of craving. And just to say that I'm not, you know, all this is why we practice on the cushion. This is why maybe we go on retreats if we can. This is why we hopefully practice very regularly our meditation practice. Because I'm not saying any of this is easy, right? But, it's been incremental that I've been able to learn how to work with all this. But I will say that I've got so much more peace. I've found so much more peace over the years through a lot of meditation practice and mindfulness, you know, continuous mindfulness and working with these ideas and bringing them in when I'm caught in a craving or before. So I just want to say that, yes, it is hard, and also you can do it. But, the other, I was listening to a talk by Ajahn Amaro, who I mentioned earlier. It was a talk on the Four Noble Truths. And one thing he said was that his teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, would always say that, you know, we're talking about nibbana, which is really peace, in another way of putting it, that Ajahn Sumedho would say, the one problem is that peace is really boring. It's not exciting at all. you know, to the mind, to the unenlightened mind that comes. So just thought that was funny, but that's not the end of it. It's often compared to, you know, you're in a room and there's maybe a kind of a loud refrigerator noise that's just kind of constantly humming in the background to the point where you kind of have tuned it out, right? But it's a bit unpleasant if you notice it. And then at some point, the hum just completely stops. And all of a sudden you realize, oh, that sound was kind of awful. And that, wow, it's a really pleasant to have it gone. And there's at least a few seconds where you kind of really enjoy the lack of the humming sound. And that it's a little bit like that, right? That when the craving drops away, and we have this experience of, quote, nibbana, even if it's a very small little taste of it, there is some sense of peace that's really tangible, and of course it can be very tangible. Kind of reminded me of I do self retreats occasionally. Try to squeeze them into my busy family life, and I was on one. I don't know. I think early this year, maybe January, and I was at a cabin in up on the Northern California coast, kind of near Gualala for anybody playing along. And anyway, I was in this, you know, Airbnb cabin kind of thing, and really enjoying my practice thing. I was feeling very peaceful, and this really terrible storm came along. And, you know, so I'm staying there inside peacefully. Tell the trees must be falling down somewhere, although I checked and fortunately there weren't any sort of scary trees near me. But it was just a really interesting contrast. Sorry, there might be a little bit of a freeze here. Can you hear me? Am I back?
You're kind of cutting in and out. I think it's your connection.
Okay. Darn. It's funny, my connection looks fine. Does it seem better now or still cutting in and out? Hate when this happens. Okay, can you hear me now? Is it better? Hello? Okay, you can hear me now. Sorry, I couldn't tell for sure. So,
could you tell us the story again that you just told? Just, I think we missed parts.
Sure.
The storm? Story? Storm?
Yeah, so I was just saying that I went on a self-retreat in you know, on the California coast, and I was renting this cabin. I'm practicing these teaching, you know, practicing diligently, feeling a lot of, you know, peace in the mind. And then outside, right outside the wind, you know, looking out the windows, there was a storm just raging all around me. It was a pretty bad storm. I can't remember, you might, but anyway, and it was just a really an interesting contrast to see the wind howling and the rain was leaking in windows. It was whipping trees around and looked pretty dangerous. Like you wouldn't really want to be driving in this storm. And then the next day, this storm kind of hit near the end of my time. The next day, the storm had passed, and there was just a lot of there were a lot of trees in the road. I had to kind of like weave my way home. Took several hours longer than usual. And because traffic, there were some places you couldn't even go. But it was really interesting. Just also the piece of the storm had passed too. And even though there was some, you know, fallout from the storm, there was a sense of, you know, peace from the storm being gone, and the craving can kind of rage through us like that. And then when it's gone, it can be, there's a tangible sense of the storm having passed. And the there's a sutta called the Nibbana Sutta in the Udanas, and the Buddha decides to rouse, inspire, and gladden the monks with the Dharma talk connected with Nibbana, and because the monks seem to have been practicing diligently and they are kind of open and receptive to what he's saying. And he says, there is, monks, that base where there is neither earth nor water nor fire nor air, neither the base of the infinity of space nor the base of the infinity of consciousness. These are deep meditative states, nor the base of nothingness, nor the base of neither perception nor non-perception, neither this world nor another world, neither sun nor moon. Here, monks, I say, there is no coming, no going, no standing still, no passing away, and no being reborn. It is not established, not moving, without support. Just this is the end of suffering. This is just one description of Nibbana from the Buddha. And one other similar talk that he gave, he same basic setup with monks who are well established in the practice. And he says, there is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, become, made, and conditioned. So this is just one way that Nibbana is talked about and kind of can be hopefully an inspiring description, the fact that we can kind of orient ourselves towards the unborn, the unconditioned, and not be so caught up by the born, the conditioned all the time, which would be, you know, how we're habitually conditioned in this world. And of course, Nibbana is one of those things that's, as you can tell, probably it's a little hard to talk about. So we're doing the best we can here. And I want to get to the Fourth Noble Truth. Just seeing that one thing that Ajahn Sumedho says, he has a book called The Four Noble Truths, and he says that, you know, that we have the insight of allowing desire to go and the realization of non-suffering, the cessation of suffering. He says these insights can only come through reflection. They cannot come through belief. So I'm not asking you to believe what I'm saying, but I'm offering reflections about all this. He says, you cannot make yourself believe or realize an insight as a willful act. It's through really contemplating and pondering these truths that the insights come to you. They come only through the mind being open and receptive to the teaching. Blind belief is certainly not advised or expected of anyone. Instead, the mind should be willing to be receptive, pondering, and considering. So and he would always say at the end of a talk, and I guess he's still saying it probably, but he always says, I offer these as reflections, you know. So that's kind of the spirit I'm offering this talk in too, that just this is for your reflection. And Gil Fronsdale wrote in The Issue at Hand, which is a book that's been out for a long time, he says, the present moment is the place where we will understand the Four Noble Truths. As we practice, first we try to stabilize ourselves in the present moment, which is what we were doing in our practice earlier tonight. And then we settle into our body, listen to the sounds or feel the sensations of breathing. And once we are in the present moment, we begin exploring our experience, what we are driven toward, desire, what we push away, aversion, and how we create our suffering. And this is really the practice that we're doing. So I think that's a helpful description. This is where we will understand the Four Noble Truths. And we will only really understand them in this present moment. So we have to be present for the experience, as they say. And then I should just talk a little about the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is the Fourth Noble Truth, is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And these are put in three, you know, baskets. There's the moral discipline group of right speech, right action, right livelihood. There's the concentration group of right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And then there's the wisdom group of right view and right intention. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says that, contrary to a common assumption, the eight path factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are not steps to be followed in sequence one after another. They are more appropriately described as components than as steps. Optimally, all eight factors should be present simultaneously, each making its own distinctive contribution, like eight interwoven strands of a cable that give the cable maximum strength. However, until that stage is reached, he says, it's inevitable that the factors of the path exhibit some degree of sequence in their development. So it's not to say you couldn't develop them sequentially or in whatever way might make sense, but that ultimately they're more like components. And you know, Gil Fronsdale described them as eight interrelated practices, and the word that we are saying is right, sometimes translated as wise, samma, S-A-M-M-A in Pali, can also mean proper, complete, or in harmony. And Gil says, in this context, right means appropriate, as when we have the right tool for the job. So we're looking at, you know, looking at it that way more than right as in right and wrong per se. And might be a lot to try to go through all eight, but it all starts with right view. Bhikkhu Bodhi famously wrote, right view is the forerunner of the entire Noble Eightfold Path, the guide for all the other factors. It enables us to understand our starting point, our destination, and the successive landmarks to pass as practice advances. If we adopt a right view, that view will steer us towards right action, which is the next step, and thereby towards freedom from suffering. And so right view it's about seeing wholesome versus unwholesome, and, you know, the actions, how unwholesome, you know, actions lead to, you know, bad outcomes, bad consequences, and wholesome actions tend to lead towards good consequences. And so we take that on, and it kind of sends us in the right direction. And then, let's see, right intention or right thought is the next one, and that's more about the intention of renunciation, being free from sense desires, the intention of goodwill or metta, or being free from ill will, and the intention of harmlessness or compassion, being free from cruelty or harmfulness. So that's the traditional way of understanding right intention. Each kind of right intention is a counterbalance, in this case, to what you might call a wrong intention of like cruelty and harmfulness. So those are kind of the wisdom pieces of all this, and let's see, I'm just kind of trying to jump ahead before we run out of time. Then there's right speech and right action, right livelihood. That's the next basket, you might say. And right speech is, you know, abstaining from false speech. So we're not We don't deceive people, and we never tell a deliberate lie. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the Buddha's stricture against lying rests upon several reasons. For one thing, lying is disruptive to social cohesion. People can live together in society only in an atmosphere of mutual trust, where they have reason to believe that others will speak the truth. By destroying the grounds for trust and inducing mass suspicion, widespread lying becomes the harbinger, signaling the fall from social solidarity to chaos. That's kind of an eye-opener in these fraught times. So that's something Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a long time ago. Feels very relevant today. Then there's also abstaining from slanderous speech. We avoid speech that causes division. And this is the idea of right speech. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says the opposite of slander, as the Buddha indicates, is speech that promotes friendship and harmony. Such speech originates from a mind of loving kindness and sympathy. It wins the trust and affection of others who feel they can confide in one without fear that their disclosures will be used against them. And but I've found it useful to remember that right speech includes not getting caught up in divisive speech. I once had a boss that was kind of, I felt like, you know, a particularly difficult boss. And I noticed that I really, part of me felt great trying to tell other people what a terrible boss she was or something. And I realized that's divisive speech. I have to stop that. And it did feel wrong, you know, felt better when I realized it and stopped doing that. It was just such an easy trap to fall into. And then the other part of right speech parts, it's abstaining from harsh speech, which can include abusive speech, insults, sarcasm, and then abstaining from idle chatter or pointless talk that lacks purpose or depth. So then Bhikkhu Bodhi says that we speak at the right time in accordance with facts. We speak what's useful, and that our speech is like a treasure uttered at the right moment, accompanied by reason, moderate and full of sense, rather than idle chatter. So, you know, these are not saying you're in trouble if you go out and have idle chatter, but it's good to have some sense of what is meant here by right speech. And we can, and this is all, you know, in the understanding that it will lead to our own happiness and the happiness of others if we can live like this, the more we can live like this. And just to notice when we're caught in, you know, pointless idle chatter, and notice what that feels like. Try to bring some mindfulness to the moment where we're, and sometimes it's appropriate to have some idle chatter with your, you know, Uber driver or something, just as a courtesy, as a kindness. So I don't think it's always, you know, so terrible, depending on, again, we could go back to intention too. But even then, I try to find something useful to say or have some point. And then just to finish up, right action means refraining from unwholesome deeds that occur with the body as their natural means of expression, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi. The pivotal element in this path factor is the mental factor of abstinence, because this abstinence applies to actions performed through the body. This is called right action. So basically not intentionally killing other beings, not taking that which is not freely offered, and that includes not stealing, robbing, or committing fraud or deceit, cheating in some way, and then also abstaining from sexual misconduct, so especially avoiding what are called illicit partners. Anyway, But the flip side of that is that we're developing kindness and compassion for other beings, and that we're not destroying life, and that we're a safe person to be around, that we are committed to being, you know, nonviolent, non-harming. And right livelihood, that we wouldn't be caught up in anything deceptive like false advertising. And then also there's five specific kinds of livelihood the Buddha pointed to that harm others and should be avoided. And it has to do with dealing in weapons or dealing in raising animals for slaughter, for example, or in meat production, or creating poisons or intoxicants. And so then just finishing up, the right effort has to do with preventing unarisen, unwholesome states, which is like the five hindrances to meditation, for example, sense pleasure, sense desire, anger, ill will, doubt, restlessness and worry, and sloth and torpor, learning how to work with those, abandon them when they do arise. And then also it's about, right efforts about arousing more wholesome states, which include the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness, investigation, energy, and all of the above. Feel like it's getting late in the talk. Right mindfulness, we kind of know what mindfulness is, but one definition or one aspect of it is avoiding getting lost in papancha, proliferation of thought. That part of, you know, right mindfulness is, having this clear presence of mind. We're really present. We're not getting caught in proliferation of thought, so that we can see things as they really are. And right concentration is a mind free from distraction. It's unified. It's not deluded or overwhelmed by worries and concerns. And it's, a one-pointedness that we're cultivating with strong right concentration in meditation. And then that affects our whole, the way we are in the world. And if we cultivate all of this, then we may have this experience, which Ajahn Chah described. He's a Thai forest monk, that Jack Kornfield's teacher. You've probably heard of him. He said, try to be mindful and let things take their course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a still forest pool. All kinds of wonderful animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the awakened one. So that is where we're headed. I love this idea of being like a still forest pool, and I imagine all these amazing animals coming in. We're just still and we're present for it. All right, well, thank you for listening. I know that was a lot to throw at you. And I don't know, we can open it up for a quick question or two if you like, or I don't know if we really have time or not. It's 9 o'clock. How late do we go? Is this it?
Yes, we end at 9.
Okay. All right, well, let's end there. Thank you, everyone. I have a website, waltopi.com, and if you can contact me through that if you had any questions or comments. Sorry that we ran out of time for more interaction. All right, take care. Thank you for your kind attention. I really appreciate it. I hope that was a useful talk. And I'll see you again next time, and hopefully I'll be in person. All right. Be well. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Why do you have to start the birthday?